Hi, everybody. My name is Kevin. If we haven't met, so glad you guys are here. Welcome to Spark. So we've been going through a series on the parables of Jesus. Parables are stories that are told that are supposed to come alongside principles or ideas that are to shed light on, to illuminate, to bring forth. And today is no different, except the parable that the pastor has asked me to cover is one that includes some very visceral images of the afterlife. And so I need to share a couple things with you. For those of you who are new to Spark and who are here, we, at the very beginning of Spark, set out on an agenda, which was to figure out who Jesus was and what did Jesus actually teach. And every now and then, the teachings of Jesus seemed to butt up against some of the things that we had traditionally known as Christians, Christian theology, especially Western Americanized Christian constructs, would be in our framework, but then we'd read what Jesus says and we'd go, well, what do we do with that now? Because this is what I thought was Christian, but then we read Jesus. And so we've been doing that for 12 years. So if you're brand new, I just want to let you know that we have a history of doing this, and this is something that's kind of core and central to our culture. So today's going to be a little bit the same. But there's a paradox. There's a paradox to that idea, which is this, is that even though we bump up against those things, I also am not in the business of telling you what to believe. And so one of the disclaimers that I'd like to share at the very beginning is that as we go through this parable, the rich man and Lazarus and hell and Hades and all those kinds of things, I want to also say to you that I am not actually attempting to try to persuade or dissuade you about beliefs about the afterlife. And you might be able to come to the conclusion of this parable and recognize, wait a second, some of the things that I believe, I don't believe anymore, and that's fine. You might come to the end of this and say, but I still believe the things that I believe, and that's fine. Because my job is not to try to convince you one way or the other, either by persuasion or manipulation, to believe certain things about the afterlife. That's not what I'm in the business of, me personally. Maybe other people at Spark, but not me. So that's my disclaimer. I shouldn't have said that out loud. But anyway, so that's my job. So if at a particular point I say something that sounds like, but it sounds like he's attacking, I might be, but it might simply be because I'm trying to draw out of the parable what Jesus is doing. And fidelity to the message and the teachings of Jesus, if you maintain faithfulness to that, you will not be hindered by what you think Jesus should be saying because of your cultural context. Does that make sense? The whole idea is to try to set that aside as best as you can and really get to the core center of what Jesus is saying here. And honestly, what he's saying here is actually pretty simple. I work by a principle frequently that people do not need to be told much more than they just need to be reminded. And I find Jesus' teachings to be very much commensurate with that idea. I don't think Jesus is telling us anything new here, but the way in which he communicates and the way in which he reminds us of this principle and truth, of course, is very brilliant, very insightful, of course, and very powerful. So we're going to talk about the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, starting in Luke chapter 16. Are you ready with that disclaimer? Buckle up. Here we go, friends. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, who feasted sumptuously every day. Yes, that is a photograph of the first century man in purple. Some of you are a little late to that one. Okay, that's fine. And at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who longed to satisfy his hunger with what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs would come and lick his sores. The poor man died and was carried away by the angels to be with Abraham. The rich man also died and was buried. Yes, in that position. In Hades, where he was being tormented, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. He called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in agony in these flames. But Abraham said, "Child, remember that during your lifetime you received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner evil things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in agony." Notice good things and evil things, the connotation there. Good and evil. Good and bad, right? The connotation of sinners, right? There's some weird non-conventional connotations going on in those terms. "Besides all this, between you and us is a great chasm that has been fixed, so that those who might want to pass from here to you cannot do so, and no one can cross from there to us." He said, "Then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, very well dressed, that he may warn them, so that they will not also come into this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. They should listen to them." He said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent." He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." I've entitled this, not very creatively, "The Rich Man, Lazarus, and the Power of Hell." Now, I have to confess that the power of hell is an homage to Huey Lewis. So I would like to amend that, I suppose, to "The Rich Man, Lazarus, and the Power of Hades." Sing along. That was a fun audio edit. "Rich Man, Lazarus, and the Power of Hades," because the word for hell there is the Greek word Hades. And we're going to get to why that's important and critical to understanding of the story. I would venture to guess that for nearly 2,000 years, this particular story has been used by Christians, religious people, fundamentalists, conservatives, liberals, everybody along the spectrum, to describe exactly what hell is like. In fact, because there are so few depictions of a tormentuous afterlife, this is one of those stories that is referenced on a regular basis. And honestly, it's very reasonable to understand that throughout history, people have interpreted these particular stories as a commentary, a theological treatise, and/or a teaching on the afterlife. Because honestly, the pictures there are so visceral. And when you search hell, Hades, Gehenna, Sheol, all of these words that are used, I mean, look at these images. They are horrifying and terrifying, and they viscerally, I mean, like when I was, like, I don't know if you're feeling this, but when I was searching these images, preparing for this, something in my gut was still like churning, like just the mere fact of looking at these images. And the reason is because for thousands of years, for longer than that, I mean, for as long as humans honestly have considered death and mortality, there has been a concern about what happens after that time and where do people go and all of those different types of things. And so the idea of Hades being the place of torment would have been an assumed or would have been a natural kind of description that Jesus would have used there. But we also have to understand that it's gone through a little bit of an evolution as well. For example, the word Hades just simply means the god of the underworld. Hades actually means the depths where you are buried. This is the upper world. There's an underworld. And if you know Greek mythology, there's a god for everything. So there's a god of the underworld, and that would have been Hades. The word hell, actually, I can't remember if I'm going to mention this later in the talk. The word hell comes through the Germanic root to mean cover over, as if you were in the ground and then you were covered over. So Hades and hell have this definition or connotation of once you die, you go there. Wherever there is in the underworld, in the place under where all of us are living, that is the place that's called Hades. There's a Hebrew word, Sheol, and this is a commonly depicted cosmology of Hebrew thought. The idea is this is probably what the ancient Hebrews thought. This is probably what the ancient Canaanites thought. Ancient Semitic people, somewhere around the 5th, 6th century BCE, all the way up to the 2nd century, anywhere in there. This is probably what they thought. There's a firmament above the sky, if you remember Genesis 1. And then underneath is the underworld, the Sheol. And you go to that place through the sea. This is part of the reason why gathered waters in the sea is often the dark place in Hebrew mythology and theology, is because that's where the underworld goes. Later on in the Hebrew scriptures, there's a place that is known as Gehenna. You will hear that phrase as well. Now, the word Gehenna is two Hebrew words, ge, which means valley, hinom, which is the name of this location. Hell is gorgeous. It's got flowers. It's a really pretty walk. It's a wonderful little waterfall on that particular side. The reason why Gehenna has been used as a place of hell is because the prophets of the Hebrew tradition teach that it was in this place that the ancient Israelites forsook the Lord, decided to worship foreign gods, and as a result of that, began to sacrifice their children in the fires of Molech. I don't even want to talk anymore about how that description alone is disturbing to my soul. To think of what they did. So Gehenna would take on the connotation of this is where ultimate depravity goes. The ancient Israelites sacrificed their children in the fires of a pagan foreign god. That, my friends, is hell. As you know, that ancient Israel is a part of a larger Mediterranean context. The Persians, of which is part of the Israelite story, they worshipped Zoroaster and a great god, Ahura Mazda. Now, part of Zoroastrian theology, and again, we won't get into the deep recesses of it, was the idea of Duzak, the idea of the underworld. And it was really Zoroastrianism that began to come up with the idea that not only do you go down into the depths, but there's got to be some sort of consequences after you die. Whatever you do up here begins to have consequences for whatever happens down there. And the idea of good things get rewarded and bad things get punished begins to make its way in this Eastern religion. Of course, the Egyptians had their own understanding called duat, where you would weigh the heart and discover whether or not this person did good or did bad, and whether or not they did good or did bad was going to be commensurate with what kind of consequences they were going to face in the underworld. All of these ideas began to converge in various eras of time. In our tradition, there are some apocryphal texts, texts that are not in your Bible, but they are written alongside the text of your Bible, Enoch being one of them, Gospel of Thomas. And if you feel like you don't want to sleep at night, take a few moments to read passages from these two about what happens to evil people in the afterworld. They are incredibly visceral, incredibly detailed, and extremely disturbing. So in the 2nd century BC and the 3rd century CE, you know, before Jesus, after Jesus, in that particular period of time, you can start to see that the idea of hell being a torturous, tormentious place because of evil things done, you're going to get torture at the end, is really starting to get codified in the minds and in the hearts and the religion and philosophy of the people. And then, of course, that gets subsumed with Christian theology and grows as Christianity becomes the state religion and has much wider influence. And then we have the very famous Dante's Inferno, where Dante outlines various levels of hell. So not only do you get punishment, but you get different kinds of punishment depending upon what. Now, how many of you are very happy you came today for this? Yeah, thrilled, thrilled. This is the evolution of this concept. Now, we could spend a long time talking about the variety of evolutions of hell, afterlife, Hades, Gehenna, Sheol, all those things, because there's nuances to all of that, and I'm skipping over a whole bunch of things, because we're talking about the parable, we're not talking about hell, but we're talking about the parable, and we're talking about hell. Anyway, we're talking about the parable. That's the principal idea. Well, here's the key thing. When you analyze these stories, these mythologies, these beliefs over the centuries, you come to one kind of simple conclusion. The afterlife theology, the afterlife philosophy, the belief in what happens after you die emerges out of a problem. And here's the problem. Is life fair? Is life fair? Do bad things get bad people get bad consequences? Do good people get good consequences? Is life fair? This is fundamentally a question of justice, and hell emerges out of this angst, this problem, this tension, this dilemma. How do we get justice? Because the answer to the question, is life fair, is what? No. Life isn't fair. We know that very evil people can succeed and thrive and do very, very well, regardless of their immorality, their evil, the fact that they disenfranchise people, the fact that they take advantage, the fact that they are greedy and lustful and all these things. We know that happens. And we know that incredibly, genuinely compassionate, good, kind-hearted, giving people get the short end of the stick and are taken advantage of by those people. Is life fair? No. And so in order to answer that question of whether or not life is fair, we have to have an afterlife to take care of why that is. After hundreds of years of development, and not soon after Jesus, throughout the first through fourth centuries, Christian theology converged and melded with all of these ancient concepts and then began to reformulate the idea of salvation. And this particular story, this parable, had then been referenced, been highly influential in Christian theology to then teach the evidence that Jesus is both affirming and teaching on hell, eternal torment, the afterlife, and moral responsibility. And so it's no wonder that we come to this parable with a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of concern, because when we read about fire, torment, suffering, chasm, there's no crossing over, this can be very concerning, especially if we already have a little bit of a kind of a predilection, a kind of a leaning towards, yeah, I am a little concerned about what happens to me after I die. And what I'd like to say as clearly as I can, taking into consideration my disclaimer at the beginning, that Jesus is not teaching on hell. This is not an exhortation, a theology, a treatise on the afterlife. This, my friends, is a parable. It is a parable. And Hades, the afterworld, the underworld, is a metaphor for something that Jesus is really pointing towards. And as I mentioned before, this is probably something we already know, not really teaching us anything, just simply reminding us. What is Jesus reminding us? This parable is an explicit and visceral condemnation of injustice, greed, callousness, discompassion, and social apathy. That's it, my friends. He tells this parable to point out the injustices, the discompassion, the way in which people live in this world in an unfair way. We came up with the concept of hell to take care of how do we make justice, how do we understand this world of fairness. We'll take care of that in the afterworld. Jesus is kind of doing this little flip. He's taking that and saying, okay, that's what we believe. Now let me use that story to change the fact that life is not fair. Hell is the solution to the problem. That's exactly correct. That's what Jesus is doing. If that's what we believe, then let's tell a story about that so that we can change what actually is happening. If there's discompassion, injustice, callousness, greed, that needs to change. Now, why do I come to that conclusion? Why should we come to that conclusion? I'm going to suggest first is Luke's economic gospel. When you read the gospel of Luke in comparison to all the others, more than the other three gospels, Matthew, Mark, and John, does Luke emphasize the economics of the kingdom? More than any of the three other gospel accounts, Luke emphasizes the good news of economic justice. A kingdom economy is a theme of the account, and it condemns discompassionate inequality just as it comforts the victims of injustice. It is a moral and social vision of what this world could be. Multiple examples of this. Luke chapter 3, and the crowds asked him, "What then should we do?" In reply, he said to them, "Whoever has two coats must share with anyone who has none, and whoever has food must do likewise." Luke chapter 3 again. Even tax collectors came to be baptized. And they asked him, "Teacher, what should we do to follow you?" Here's what he said. "Collect no more than the amount prescribed for you. Do not economically take advantage of the people that you're supposed to take taxes from." Luke chapter 3 again. Soldiers asked him, "And we, what should we do?" I mean, he's a Roman soldier. "Forget Caesar, bow down and worship me." Now that's part in there, but in Luke, "Do not extort money from anyone by threats or false accusation and be satisfied with your wages." The emphasis throughout this chapter is on the economics of how you behave. Later on, Luke chapter 4, there's this famous story of him going to Nazareth, and he describes and declares the Jubilee. What's the Jubilee? The canceling of economic debt. Not holding over the debt to other people. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor." There's this famous portion of Jesus' teaching called Sermon on the Mount. Matthew is known as, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Oh, is that, yeah, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Luke doesn't have "in spirit." Luke says, "Blessed are the poor." There's no qualifier there. Matthew qualifies it with poor in spirit. Luke is very explicit. "Blessed are you that don't have enough money to live, to make it, who do not have the means to thrive in this world. Blessed are you who are hungry." Now, what is Matthew? Hunger and thirst for righteousness, right? He spiritualizes it. Luke, very explicit. "Blessed are you who are hungry." You can't even put food on the table, for you will be filled. Luke chapter 12, he said to them, "Beware, keep yourself from covetousness, for a man's life does not consist of the abundance of the things which he possesses." Luke chapter 3 again, "Sell your possessions, give alms, make purses for yourselves that do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven where no thief comes near and no moth destroys, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." And right before Luke 16, where he tells the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, he says this. The Pharisees, or the narrator says this, "The Pharisees, who were lovers of money, heard all this, and they ridiculed him. So he said to them, 'You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of others, but God knows your hearts, for what is prized by humans is an abomination in the sight of God.'" Luke, more than any other writer, pounds home money, economics, means, wealth. This is a principal theme of Luke. So it's no wonder that when we get to this parable, he's talking about wealth. Notice in the parable too, it's like our conception of hell is about whether or not you believe certain things. That particular story of hell is whether or not you have things and are discompassionate versus don't have things. That's what sends you to hell. And one of the titles that I was working on with this was like, rich man, Lazarus, and how I'm on my way to hell. Because for all practical purposes in this particular life, I'm doing well. And thank God, and we can talk about economics later, but that's the setup in this story. So Luke has a context, economic justice, kingdom economics. Now let's take a look at the parable within that context. There are some nuances and pieces of this parable that are just honestly, brilliant. Purple and fine linen are what? They're descriptions of the wealthy, the elite, royalty, Roman aristocracy, people that are really, really, really doing well and like to show it. There's also literary parallelism. I don't know if you noticed this in the story. There's a gate that separates the poor man and the rich man. In the afterlife, there's this chasm that separates the poor man and the rich man. There are these good things, and then there are these evil things. There's the table, and then there's agony. And if you take a close look and compare the before and the after, the before life and the afterlife, they kind of switch places. Ah, the thing that you had, now he has. The thing that he has, now you have. There is a parallelism that is happening there in the literature to describe, to illustrate, to drive home the point. Don't you see what you are and what you are doing? There's this painful, ironic tragedy because the rich man is also a child of Abraham. The rich man belongs to the covenant promises of the people of God. He calls Abraham father, And Abraham actually calls him child. There's this almost painful, intimate relationship that feels broken. This rich man knows the story. He knows the history. He knows Abraham. And yet he has forsaken that which Abraham and Moses and the prophets taught. There's this brilliant anthropomorphism. Even the dogs are there licking the sores. Even the dogs have more compassion on this man than you do. And then, of course, there is this tragedy of the parable. And this is something that's really painful and brilliant. The mere fact that the parable even needs to be told is itself a tragedy. He says at the very end, you have Moses, you have prophets, you already know this. This is something you are already aware. He says, yeah, but send somebody back from the dead. Even a dead man rising will not convince. There is something not wrong with your knowledge. There's something wrong with your heart. There's something wrong with your eyes. There's something wrong with your soul. You cannot see right outside your gate. Now, just to be clear again about what we're talking about in the theology, there is no mention of a conversion here. There's no beliefs about the rich man or the poor man, and there's no confession of Jesus as Lord, and there's no moral behavioralism. And again, this is one talk on the parable, and there's further discussion to be had regarding the theology of wealth, money, all of those concepts. In this story, Jesus is explicitly telling the audience, your injustice, discompassionate, greedy wealth is hellacious. Do you not see? Do you not understand what all of your hoarding of wealth is doing to your fellow man? And you clearly don't see it. But the dogs do. They're even more compassionate than you are. And so once again, the explicit teaching of this parable is an exhortation against that kind of greed. And to cast a vision of what kind of social reality we could all have. Not only for the poor man, but also for the rich man. Because something happens, or should happen, and the story doesn't tell us, but something should happen as a result. To get at that, what should the rich man do? What should the Pharisees do? What should the Roman aristocracy do? How should they respond? What should those of us with means do? How should we respond to that parable? Well, we don't really get insight in the parable in the gospel, but we do get insight in this brilliant depiction of this exact same parable. A Christmas Carol is a depiction of Ebenezer Scrooge, story by Charles Dickens, of course, famous literary giant of our culture. And what he depicts in this story, in this movie, is really brilliant because it gets at the heart of what's happening in this parable of the rich man and Lazarus. For those of you who need a quick refresher, Ebenezer Scrooge is a wealthy, greedy, discompassionate, uncaring, calloused individual. He has a lot of means, and he's very miserly. He's not generous. So even though people around him are suffering, he doesn't care. He has a dream, ghost of Christmas past, present, and future, and these ghosts that show up in his dream terrorize him by what his actions are doing. After the terror, he wakes up from the dream. And watch what happens to Ebenezer Scrooge after the vision of the terror.
My own room. I'm alive. Oh, thank you, Spirit. I will keep my promise. I will live in the past, present, and the future. The spirits of all three will strive within me. Oh, heaven and Christmas time be praised for this. I say this on my knees, Jacob Marley. On my knees.
Hello, you there, boy.
Me, sir?
Yes, you, my good fellow. What day is today?
Today? Why, it's Christmas Day, of course.
Christmas Day? I haven't missed it. The spirits did it all in one night. Well, they can do anything they like, of course they can. Hello, my fine fellow.
Hello.
Do you know the Poulterers in the next street but one, on the corner?
I should hope I did.
Intelligent boy, remarkable boy. Do you know if they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging there?
What, the one as big as me?
Delightful boy. Pleasure talking to you. The one as big as you.
It's hanging there now.
Well, go and buy it. Yes, go and buy it and bring them round so that I may tell them where to deliver it. Come back with the man, I'll give you a shilling. Come back in less than 5 minutes, I'll give you half a crown.
I love that clip. Did you hear what he said? The spirits did it all in one night. Well, they can do whatever they like. Of course they can, right? Like, I mean, they're just the spirits. Now, notice what he didn't do throughout the rest of the story. He didn't go try to convince other people, did you know that there's a ghost of Christmas past? Now, I need to develop a proselytization program to make sure that everybody knows that there's a ghost of Christmas past and there's a ghost of Christmas future and you need to know about these ghosts. No, none of that is happening there. He has a change of heart. He begins to see more clearly. And what I love about that clip is, you know, Scrooge is still the name that we use for the people that are just so, you know, I don't care about you. Like, so heartless and, you know, it's the Grinch. It's all of that stuff. The joy in his face. There wasn't a fear of the afterlife. That doesn't exist in this story. He's now not all of a sudden concerned, how do I not, you know, face the ghost of Christmas future again? Because that was terrifying. The story is not intended to scare us out of hell. These stories are intended to scare the hell out of us. Oh, yeah, that's a good saying. I should probably start saying that. Maybe I should say that a little bit more often. Quite literally, the hell, the covering over, the dark place, the place where dead people are buried, where there's no seeing, understanding the world, that lives in us. Where I can't see. I'm covered over. I don't have any compassion. I don't have any care. That underworld, that realm of the dead, Jesus even uses this phrase, whitewashed sepulchres. You whitewashed tombs. You look so good, but inside you're filled of dead people's bones. So this is an image that is constantly in Jesus' lips and teachings. That's the thing that the hell story is supposed to scare out of us. Not the concern about whether or not we're going there. Ebenezer Scrooge is not concerned anymore. Notice, and this is what I love, note the joy. What a delightful boy. Oh, I'm so enjoying having this conversation. His eyes are open and he begins to see the world in a different place. The fear and the terror of the ghosts did not cause Ebenezer to now become fearful and terrified of ghosts. The fear and the terror of the ghosts awakened him to the people in front of him, to the joyous opportunity of generosity and kindness and goodness that awaits him in this world. And that, my friends, is exactly the point of the rich man and the Lazarus and hell. The point of that particular story is not so that you all of a sudden and that Christians over the years have now developed a sense of a fear of how do you get in, how do you not get in, how do you go to the good place versus the bad place. The point of the story is to scare that hell out of us so we begin to see the world through new eyes, with a new heart, with a new soul. I did not realize the suffering of my fellow human beings. I was blind to seeing how actions taken by powerful people hurt others. I did not connect with their suffering. The point is to fear your own callousness, your own greed, your own indifference and discompassion to the suffering around you. Again, the story is not intended to scare us out of hell. The story is intended to scare the hell out of us. I propose to you, my friends, Jesus is not interested in changing your theology of the afterlife, and neither am I. Again, what I said at the beginning, whatever you want to believe about the afterlife is fine. What Jesus is doing here in this story, in this parable, he wants to change your heart. And if showing you a depiction of yourself in burning flames is going to do it, just like Ebenezer Scrooge, then let's go there. You have Moses, you have prophets, you have the books, you have the teachings, you have a phenomenal teaching team at Spark Church. You have everything you need. You're still not getting it. So let me tell you a parable. Do you see how that works? They have Moses. Someone rise from the... You still don't get it. So let me tell you the parable. Yes, our choices have eternal consequences. What I do now will cause some sort of suffering or pain, or some sort of joy and celebration. And then lastly, be very, very careful as you grow. Again, this is not a theology of money. There's plenty to discuss about what Jesus talked about, because Luke also talks about very wealthy people supporting Jesus. So this is not a condemnation of having wealth. Notice that. That's a different talk. Be very careful as you grow in wealth, because what happens to you as you gain means? What happens to you? And all of us know. All of us have experienced what it's like to scrounge for ramen in the dorm room, and then what it is to be able to buy your house and buy your clothes and your car and to take vacations and stuff. And I think we also know the experience of what happens to our mindset when that happens. And there is a correlation. It's so crazy. People who don't have means are generally more generous than people who do. When you do like the analytics of giving, it's really amazing. And so the end of the story of Ebenezer Scrooge is once again the same lesson of the rich man and Lazarus.
Ebenezer Scrooge was better than his word. He became as good a friend, as good a master, as good a man as the old city knew. And to Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father. It was said of Ebenezer Scrooge that he knew how to keep Christmas well, if any man alive possessed the knowledge. May that be truly said of us, and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us. Everyone.
All right, my friends, may God bless us, everyone, with this knowledge, this new insight, this change of heart that transforms our apathy into compassion to create the kingdom economics of Jesus' vision necessary for a just and life-giving society for all. And it might just save your life. Say it with me, come on. That's the power
of Hades.
Thank you very much. Every time we come to the table, we participate also in symbols and metaphors that are to remind us of who we are, from where we've come from, and who we are to be, and to cast a vision for the world. One of the things we say every single week is that everyone is welcome at the table. Guess what? We don't care how much money you have. We don't care how much money you don't have. We don't care how generous or ungenerous you've been. We don't care about any of that stuff, because this is not our table. This is Christ's table. And that vision is supposed to awaken us to making sure that everybody is welcome and invited. So as we sing, we're going to invite you to come, take the elements and partake. And as you do, you ingest into yourselves the vision, the teachings, the parable, the hope, the vision of what Jesus intended for you and for this world. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. My dear friends, all are welcome at this table. Please come as we sing.